Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. One of the guests and attendees of the Los Angeles Times Book Festival this year is Joyce Carol Oates, whose newest book is a collection of selected stories from 1966 to 2006 called High Lonesome. Of these stories, 11 of them are brand new, or at least first published in book form, and there are 25 selected. As I was reading, I was amazed all over again to see how many different kinds of stories are contained here. But in particular, I noticed that in a short story that I have come to think of as characteristic of you, something has happened before the story began, and something will happen after the story is over. And the story is really middle, consciousness between events. And I found it very interesting to see how many of the events, as the stories have progressed over time, how the story is no longer a set piece. There's an early story here upon the sweeping flood, which really provides a set piece flood that's astonishing. And the amount of physical action in the story is overwhelming. But as the art progresses, it seems as if you have allowed yourself to enter consciousness rather than event.
That's so interesting, Michael. I'm actually working on a short story at this very moment, and what you say is very relevant. I had not thought of it that way, but I have to absorb this. It's a very interesting remark. I think I have tried once in a while to have stories that begin at the beginning and they end at the end, and they tend to be focus and dramatic stories with a lot of dialogue, let's say. But the kind of story that maybe is a little closer to my heart that I've evolved into writing is definitely what you've suggested. It's a drama of consciousness in which someone is remembering a backstory, and then the consequences of the backstory begin to operate in the present story, and then there will be an exchange of some kind, and then there will be an ending. But it's like there's a condensed drama rather than a drama that's presented.
It interests me, too, in that once in the early stories, say, in The Region of Ice, which is also in the collection, there's a confrontation between opposing ideas of the world. And it was once said that a short story needs conflict. But more recently, it seems to me that these are meetings of worlds that, in a sense, refuse to oppose one another. I'm thinking of the new novel that will come out, for instance, where the daughter of a famous 60s lawyer encounters her college roommate, a black American, who is a church-going American, who has none of the qualities that she expects to find. And that seems to be an element here, looking not for the expected conflict, but the breakage of communication because conflict doesn't exist.
That's
two
right.
Worlds are set in opposition, but they don't meet.
There's not the acknowledgement. Yes, we sometimes are confronted with people who are in a state of denial about their own predicament. And so the drama is, how can we illuminate these people who are in a state of denial about their own predicament, which I see a state of denial all around me. I mean, I'm sure I participate in it myself, but it seems to be quite characteristic of whole nations who careen and veer into treacherous waters without looking ahead. In a sense, they can look ahead and see quite clearly that what they're doing is treacherous and dangerous, but in a kind of collective way, this sort of hypnosis, and they don't see where they're going. I certainly have seen this in my fellow Americans.
Can you speak a bit about hypnosis, because it seems to be part of the picture of consciousness that many of these stories present, that there's a movement into a deeper, unarticulate level of the self that seems to move entranced to dramatize the story, but not necessarily to take part in it.
Well, I think many people, who are even people who are of action, are also fantasists. And to a degree that many people perhaps are not aware, we all indulge in fantasies quite often. So when an action or a confrontation erupts into consciousness, it's often been prepared for quite a while in the unconscious. As you say, this is sort of self-hypnosis, I think.
Yeah. In one of the stories, the worlds of the story do interpenetrate, usually because of an act of will. There's the story Two Cousins, where one has read the work, a Holocaust memoir of her lost cousin, and she is very persistent in sending letters and wanting to be acknowledged. In fact, these stories seem to begin in a demand for, a need for acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. And it seems as if now these characters are demanding their right to participate in a story.
Well, that's an interesting insight, yes. The story, The Cousins, is one of the few stories I've ever written that's all entirely letters, just letters without any narration, so that we hear two very disparate voices. It turns out that the two women are cousins, but we don't really know that at the beginning.
And one is very forcefully interested in avoiding contact.
That's right.
It's interesting, too, because that same impulse, the yearning to be acknowledged, to have a home, is at the heart of BD 11187.
Oh, in a very different way, yes.
Yes. But it's quite an interesting story in that, you know, it's a genre story to some extent, dystopian.
Yes.
And yet at the end, when a young man realizes that he has been raised to be a body donor, he feels finally fully adopted. And his yearning to be someone's, as opposed to a member temporary of a foster family, it seems almost as if those two stories are cousins in a sense.
Well, it's a very interesting insight. As always, when I'm having a conversation with you, Michael, I'm startled by connections that I myself have not been aware of until this very moment. So it's difficult for me sometimes to comment on them. But I think that as a reader, you obviously are thinking, you're thinking in a way like a writer as you read. You're putting things together. Whereas I'm the writer, and I don't necessarily read the stories in the juxtaposition that you're reading them in. I work on a story very intensely, and it seems to me self-enclosed. And then when I'm done with it, I will move on to another project. And I'm not aware of the what you could call the aftermath or the tendrils, the subterranean roots that are connecting the stories. I'm not that aware of them myself, but an assiduous reader would see them.
Now tell me, when you were putting together the anthology then, did you reread the early work? Are these your choices?
Oh, to some extent they're my choices. I was also guided by suggestions because some of the stories have been anthologized many times. And I felt that I didn't necessarily want to anthologize them again, but my editor said, well, you have to do that because these are well-known stories and people would wonder where they were. So that was the logic of including stories like Where You're Going, Where Have You Been, that have been anthologized many times. So I was guided by some outside suggestions, and then just others, by my own sense of what I wanted this anthology to be. It's called High Lonesome, and that title refers to one of the news stories, but it also seems to suggest a certain tone of people who are alone, and there's a sort of melancholy romance of the lonesome, the experience of being lonesome. I think of short stories as celebrating a certain kind of romance of being alone. I think of reading as a kind of romantic alone activity that you're doing. The image would be of being curled up somewhere on a rainy day and you're reading and very intensely involved in a world that nobody can see that world except you because it's inside your head.
It seems to me amazing because, you know, there are some nearly 20 books of short stories at least by now, and there are 25 of the past stories here. It's almost as if one wanted two or three volumes because they do seem to me to be such incredible accomplishments in the art of working out stories. In fact, in that early story, In the Region of Ice, am I getting its title correct?
Yes, that's right.
Thank you. A student says of Shakespeare to Sister Irene, his teacher, these two plays have such different worlds that they present. They don't seem consistent at all. And she answers that it is not required that there be consistency between the plays, rather that each of them is a sample worldview. And it seems here, too, that the stories move through many possibilities of world presentation, that they're not meant to be consistent so much as magnificent individualities, and that each story is an individual.
Yes, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I've always been struck by William James's remark that each position or each point in the universe is its own perspective. It's a kind of sense of pluralism. And I think if you are a novelist, especially an old-fashioned novelist who illuminates different points of view, you tend to see people in an aggregate rather than just focusing on one person.
Did these characters, do they remain in your imagination subsequently?
The characters often do, but also the dramatic episodes. I think of some of our lives as coming into a kind of crystallized clarity in moments of extreme drama where we define ourselves, or we are defined by drama. I mean, we think of Macbeth, for instance, always in terms of the events of his life rather than Macbeth without. There isn't any Macbeth apart from the actual plot of the Shakespearean tragedy. So for me, the characters are involved in the actions that define them. When we think about ourselves, I think it's much more difficult to define ourselves because we see ourselves from inside, and we know that when we act, the actions may be just little like spikes in consciousness, and we have this other deep subterranean flow that is really us. Emerson said a person is what he's thinking all day long, and I tend to feel that that's true. But when we look at literature, something of the opposite, I think, is true.
You have mentioned in the past that you drew subjects for stories from newspapers. And as I was reading these stories, I thought of the photographer who wanted to document what it was to be a citizen in a town. And to do so, he took picture after picture so that, in a sense, inclusiveness was his theme, that you could define a people by discovering them individual by individual. Has there been something of that sort in your belief about character?
Yes, there may be. I've often felt that to tell the story of our time or my time, I would just need a really broad canvas. Again, it's a very thought-provoking question. When you're writing a short story, though, the effort is to depopulate and select, and you leave so much out of a short story, it becomes almost like a skeleton, whereas a novel has a very different pacing, and it's much more different consciousness for a novel. Not with a novel, you can include almost anything. With a short story, you have to really justify each line.
I'm speaking with Joyce Carol Oates, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Joyce Carol Oates' new book, High Lonesome Stories, 1966 to 2006, is an anthology as well as an advance. It's published by Echo Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates about her book of stories, High Lonesome. In many short stories, determining the author's allegiance, where the author situates himself in relation to the characters, is necessary to an understanding of the story. But in your stories, there's a kind of impartiality. Sometimes, if you were to imagine a conversation with Joyce Carol Oates in which you asked, well, which of the characters did you care about most? You can imagine sometimes the answer being, well, I didn't care about any of them. I was interested in their placements and displacement in relation to one another.
Well, I usually do care about them quite a bit, but I have to be very careful not to seem sentimental. So I do take a lot of things out that might indicate more of my emotional leanings. I'll just make an interesting, analog to Elizabeth Bishop. I have been reading this wonderful book that Alice Quinn put together of the Elizabeth Bishop's unpublished and uncollected poems. And it's so interesting, Michael, because there you'll see a poem almost confessional with emotion and raw autobiographical information. But then when Elizabeth Bishop worked and revised the poems and polished them and tinkered with them and finally published them, they became less and less personal and more impersonal. People like her poetry or even love it because it's so beautifully written. But I found myself quite moved by the unpublished forms of the poems because there it seemed we were confronting more of an emotional directness, which I found quite startling and rather wonderful and disturbing. Then in my own writing, I don't usually write anything that's confessional. I rarely write, almost never. If I've written thousands of pages, maybe one page would be confessional of all that. So I do invest my characters with much of my own emotions. But as I said a minute ago, I do have to be careful not to be sentimental, not to be over the top. I think it's better to have a kind of a Hemingway understatement than an overstatement.
Sometimes you can tell, certainly in the new story in the collection, the story based on the life of Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, yes, Fat Man, My Love.
there's very little affection for
the
figure, that kind of artist figure, and the way in which art seals off the wounds that he is suffering from.
Yes, well, that's an unusual story. I'm glad that you mentioned that, Michael. Fat Man, My Love. That's one of the more experimental stories in the volume, and most of the stories are more traditional and conventional. But Fat Man, My Love, I thought of as a story that's based upon the rhythms of speech. The sentences are very short and repetitive and staccato and percussive and ironic, and they add up to an emotional statement. But it's not even exaggerated in a way that Fat Man is her love. That Fat Man, for all his terrible flaws, and Alfred Hitchcock was a terrible man in many ways, but nonetheless, as the narrator says, he had passion. He thought he was God, but at least he thought he was God. Most people don't even have those thoughts, she says. He may have been a megalomaniac, but at least he had that passion and he made these movies. I had been invited to write a biography of Alfred Hitchcock for James Atlas's series of biographies, Short Lives, I think they're called. And I started taking notes and saw the movies and read other biographies and realized that he was such a despicable person that I actually could not write about him. So all that remained of my notes, I had maybe 100 pages of notes, got condensed into a rather hysterical short story that's told by somebody not unlike Tippi Hedren. It is not by her, but it's by somebody not unlike her.
But that the character of Hitchcock seems to have certain qualities in common with the Ivy Compton Burnett that you dislike in a review. It's a person who is lacquering pain under a surface of tricks and ironies.
That's right. That's right. Hitchcock thought of films as practical jokes, and he thought of actors as cattle. I mean, he certainly was in love with Grace Kelly. He may not have thought of her as cattle or James Stewart. He didn't admire them very much. But other actors he really treated in a kind of despicable way.
But it seems to be really the reverse, almost as if the message of Joyce Carol Oates' stories taken in groups or en masse is everyone deserves his story. No one should be ridiculed for yearning for a story, even if it is a sentimental yearning, mm-hmm. even if some of the stories are quite destructive. They're not to be told with distance and mm-hmm. under glass. There's an attempt to penetrate the feeling zone that a person's life organizes itself around and to sort of revile the trick story. It's almost like your answer to Nabokov in Expensive People, a sense that, no, we cannot, I don't want a structure made of illusions and metamorphoses mm-hmm. into art. There must be some level at which the heart and soul of the person mm-hmm. is respected in the art.
Yes, yes. And I, one of the last times we spoke, we were talking about so-called ordinary people and how their lives are not intellectual and are not literary, but they have deep feelings. And even though ordinary people, so to speak, don't articulate their thoughts in beautiful language, yet they have thoughts, and the thoughts are deep, and their feelings are subtle. And when I wrote a novel called Missing Mom, I was trying to honor all that world out there that doesn't write books and maybe doesn't read books, but is living and nurturing and raising families and living and dying, and somehow needs the stories to be acknowledged.
Tell me, when you've put together a book like this, as you have several times in the past, there's a collection choosing the early stories that I believe Ontario Review published, do you come to any conclusions about what you want to do or what you no longer want to do in the future?
That's another astute question. That's a very good question. I'm not sure how to answer that. I tend to be so focused on what I'm working on. I'm working on a short story now, even two short stories, which I'm writing in longhand. And there's a certain tension and anxiety in me as to how they will turn out. I always have the final lines of my stories, but I don't necessarily have the way of getting to these final lines. So it does evoke some anxiety. I suppose simply as I move on in my life, there are some things that I don't do anymore. I would say to myself, well, I've told that story. I would not tell that story again. And having written a story using letters, I loved writing the story, the cousins. I loved that. So then I wrote another story using letters that will come out in the Yale Review. And having done that now twice, I probably will not do it again, even though I have to say I love doing it. And I love reading stories that are letters or novels. They're not written very, very often today. It's obviously fallen by the wayside. Maybe email exchanges.
Well, I love the letters in Diary of a Madman, when suddenly you become privy to the letters between two pet dogs.
Oh.
And they're commenting.
That's
and
great.
Ultimately, of course, they're written by the madman, but nevertheless.
What a great idea.
What a great idea it was.
Yeah, I always wanted to write a novel. Maybe I guess I probably won't. That would be written from the point of view of a cat, a very spoiled Siamese cat in a household who observes what's going on. And I got the cat very clearly, but I didn't get the human beings.
They resisted you.
So far, but it seems like a nice idea.
I've been speaking with Joyce Carol Oates on the occasion of the publication of a, really, anthology of her short stories so far. It's a selection called High Lonesome Stories 1966 to 2006, published by Echo Press. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Ages back to days of old, when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and more than 800 other Bookworm broadcasts can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm.
Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.